Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, Monday Morning Mayor Watch, as the new public advocate advocates for a candidate for police commissioner. Will Letitia James get her man from Brooklyn, from Bill de Blasio? And Monday Morning Washington Watch, as Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is in a fight with the Pentagon over sexual assault in the military. And we will tell you the names of the two New York City area Democrats who voted with the House Republicans on Friday to remove Obamacare's insurance policy standards. And later this morning, with your help, we will crowdsource a New York City borough taxi anecdotal map. Call in later from any neighborhood where the yellow cabs don't go and tell us if the green cabs are showing up. But now let's get to those Monday morning politics. WNYC political reporter Bridget Bergen is here. So is Ozzie Pabra from Capital New York. Good morning, Bridget. Good morning, Ozzie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So public advocate Letitia James is now publicly advocating Philip Banks to be the new police commissioner. Bridget, what can you tell us about Phil Banks and why Letitia James would be going public in his corner?
Well, he's one of the people who's been talked about among the, you know, as we look at the de Blasio transition. He's the chief of department, the agency's top-ranking uniform position at the NYPD. And he's someone who I think is recognized as being widely respected within the department, relatively well-liked. You know, the incoming public advocate, Letitia James, is putting the force of her endorsement behind him and saying that she is making it clear to incoming mayor-elect Bill de Blasio that he is someone who she supports as the new police commissioner.
Do they have a relationship, as far as you know, Banks and her? I know they're both from Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, I know that they're both from Brooklyn, but the extent of their relationship beyond that, I'm not familiar with.
Ozzie, should I assume that someone Letitia James is publicly advocating for police commissioner is an opponent of stop and frisk?
Well, it's interesting. So he got this position because he was promoted by Ray Kelly, someone who Bill de Blasio said is gone if he's elected. So you have that sort of lineage right there. And a lot of the press clippings about Philip Banks come around this promotion he got. So during that promotion, it was around the time that there was a lot of debate about stop and frisk. And he, standing right next to Ray Kelly during the announcement, he said, look, it's an effective strategy if done correctly. Now, there's a lot of ways to parse that. But if you're, in essence, defending the general concept of stop and frisk and that it's, you know, done correctly and you're standing with the police commissioner who's been using it widely, you're sort of more in the camp of like a pro stop and frisk sort of law enforcement officer, whereas other people who have been mentioned for the position or at least the de Blasio campaign has sort of positioned themselves as slightly more oppositional to it, saying we have to reduce the number. He had once said it's being used at a fatal dose, and then he said we're going to end the stop and frisk era. So if you look at the camps of where people are based on how they talk about it, it looks like de Blasio's on one side. And you could argue that Philip Banks might actually be in the other camp.
Huh. And yet he might choose him as his police commissioner. Bridget, you said you were at the transition tent yesterday, this tent in Lower Manhattan at Canal and Varick, which is not officially affiliated with the campaign, but where a lot of what do you want from the de Blasio administration conversations are taking place and seems kind of philosophically aligned.
Yeah, I mean, it's filled with people who are talking about every issue kind of under the sun, whether it's policing strategy to, you know, how to have affordable food access within the city. And for the first time, the co-chairs of de Blasio's transition team paid a visit to the tent yesterday. And of course, you know, the question that we all wanted to know from them is, when are you going to start announcing these appointments? Who are the people that are on the list? How many people have you talked to? And at this point, you know, we got very little information to satisfy those questions.
But were telling me there was a sense in some of the conversation about police commissioner that something.
Yeah, I mean, they're without ever mentioning some of the other candidates by name, one of whom is, you know, former NYPD Commissioner Bill Bratton, there was this sense that there's a real emphasis on making sure that the next administration is diverse and that the next administration, you know, lives up to the ideals of the de Blasio campaign. And it wasn't clear that Bratton as a choice would necessarily fulfill that.
Bratton's white and the other candidate we were talking about is black.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, there are other candidates who, you know, are also as part of this conversation that are putting themselves out there. Rafael Pinheiro, who is another member of the NYPD, is someone who has, you know, said that he has what is needed to be in this position, and he would be a Latino candidate. And so there's certainly
another very high top
NYPD
official.
Absolutely.
Like right up there with Phil Banks.
Absolutely.
So to me, to step back from which candidate it might be for police commissioner, but James stepping out as public advocate and endorsing somebody, Ozzie, to me, one of the interesting dynamics of the incoming city leadership is how independent the public advocate will be from the mayor. One of her main jobs is watchdog over the mayor, but James and de Blasio are close political allies. So it's a different relationship out of the gate from de Blasio as public advocate watchdogging Bloomberg or Mark Green watchdogging
right.
Giuliani in the 90s. You know, they were much more naturally adversarial relationships.
Right. They were adversarial just from the outset. And what has what you hear Bill de Blasio say and what Tish James say is that, yes, they agree broad brushstrokes on the goals and usually about how to get there. And what James has said whenever she's been asked this question of how are you going to be a watchdog on someone who you're aligned with, who you're friends with, who you've worked together with, she's basically indicated that she's going to keep him honest. That if he deviates from the campaign pledges that a lot of people rallied around, she's going to be the one to call him out on it. So it's not so much that they're going to disagree on policy, is that she's going to remind him of the campaign rhetoric that
the things that they agree on and hold him to it when
right.
he gets faced with making these often necessary compromise that somebody who's actually governing feels they need to make rather than somebody who's campaigning.
Right. And remember, during the primary, what was the big criticism about de Blasio? Was that he was a flip-flopper. He took one position here and then took another position there. That's what Bill Thompson and Christine Quinn had said during the primary before they endorsed him after the primary. But the idea that he's pragmatic, the idea that he can take a position, get some more information, and evolve, change his stance, is something that his critics have pointed out. So if that's something that even the people who ended up endorsing him have mentioned, somebody like Tish James saying, I'm going to remind him of the campaign promises and keep him steady, that may not be, you know, an unimportant role for someone to play.
So, listeners, we're going to play a clip of de Blasio in a minute speaking to a Reverend Al Sharpton National Action Network audience in Harlem over the weekend, at which he said he wants to be not just progressive, but aggressively progressive. So you can call us up for the next few minutes on anything you want to say about this transition period in New York City. But if you want Mayor-elect de Blasio to be aggressively progressive, what would that look like? That's part of what they're taking at that tent, the transition tent, right? A kind of a wish list. You know, drop your penny in the fountain and say what you want the new mayor to do. There's no real fountain there. But call up
there,
with us, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, especially for now, for those of you who want him to be aggressively progressive, his own language now. What would that look like besides pre-K and this little tax on people making over $500,000 a year to fund it? Bridget, you said there are stickers?
Yeah, I mean, the equivalent of the fountain. There are lots of ways at this tent for people to, you know, talk about what they think the incoming administration should do and what, you know, their vision of, you know, a de Blasio administration should look like. And, you know, they talk about things that they think that should be on the top of the mayor's to-do list. There's actually a quiz that people who go there can fill out. And then all of this data that they're gathering at this tent, they have said they are going to give to the de Blasio administration for them to do with what they will. And the co-chairs said yesterday that they plan to look at it and they plan to see. And it's all about, you know, what are your top priorities? Is it affordable housing? Is it education? And, you know, how do you think the administration should start tackling those issues?
So, listeners, you can give us your suggestions in sticker form. Think of these as audio stickers. Six words on how aggressively progressive you want Mayor de Blasio to be, or to do what in particular with his aggressive progressivity? 212-433-WNYC, and we'll get some of those calls that are coming in. Oh, is it? Look. Well, we have the public advocate-elect calling in. So, cool. Let's talk to her. Public advocate-elect James, is that really you?
Hey, Brian, how are you? Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Ozzy.
I can vouch for the voice. This is Letitia James. So you were listening, and?
And I just want you to know I do not have a relationship with Chief Banks, one way or the other. All I know is that I've respected him over the years. I've disagreed with him from time to time, and I think he would be an excellent commissioner of the city of New York, someone who will reform stop and frisk, someone who has an independent mind, and someone who I believe will who supports part of our progressive agenda going forward.
How do you know he'll reform stop and frisk if what Ozzy said earlier is true, that he had been in the past a supporter of the administration?
Because of some of the comments that he had made, he indicated at some point in time, I was reading or I heard, that he was stopped and frisked himself. And then he understands a lot of the issues and concerns that particularly communities of color are dealing with and have complained about with respect to stop and frisk. And he recognizes that it's an important crime-fighting tool, but that it needs to be reformed and that we need to do it consistent with the law. And I support that position as well. And so he said that while he was working for Police Commissioner Kelly, and he said that, you know, under the direction, I mean, he said that as he was working for Mayor Bloomberg. And so I just think that it would be a refreshing change. I know his brother is in the educational field. His father was a police officer. So I support and endorse Banks, and yesterday he was a keynote speaker at a church in my district, and what he talked about was respecting the community, and if all of us respected the community and said hello to residents in the community, it would go a long way improving police relations. This was a church that was in a public housing complex. It was a church that is pastored by Reverend Fred Lucas, who has been active all in central Brooklyn and throughout the city of New York, a very respected preacher and pastor. And so he basically said to the 200 police officers who were there, you need to respect the community that you serve. You need to recognize that they have mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers, and they needed to be treated with the same respect mm-hmm. you treat your family.
Should I take from your endorsement of Phil Banks that Mayor-elect de Blasio might be leaning that way, because you wouldn't want to be on the losing side of this as sort of your first public act. Do you have any indication from him that he's leaning Phil Banks?
Well, this is not my first public act, and, you know, I don't mind being, if from time to time, being on the losing side, as long as it's the right side for me. It's not important that you always be on the winning side. It's important that you stand up for what you believe is right. And I believe that Chief Banks would be an excellent candidate, is an excellent candidate, and would make an excellent commissioner of the city of New York.
All right. Do you want to endorse any other candidates for anything else, school's chancellor or anything, before you go?
Yeah, so I think Marty Markowitz would be a great ambassador of protocol for New York City. He would be a great CEO of tourism.
Spoken like a Brooklynite. Ozzy, did you want to say something?
That's actually, I don't think that's really a bad idea, the tourism person. You can't get a louder cheerleader for New York, or at least for Brooklyn, than Marty Markowitz.
Letitia James, incoming public advocate, thank you for chiming in, and we'll have you in the studio as a guest soon.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we talk Monday morning New York City politics with WNYC's Bridget Bergen and Ozzy Paber from Capital New York. Ozzy, that was a surprise. Did you learn anything?
Well, that she considers to be in line with Phil Banks on the issue of stop and frisk. I mean, that is interesting. Like, we'll see further down the road if there's more transparency from this transition committee, if they too feel the same way about Philip Banks.
I thought it was also interesting the way she described how he thinks the police should be interacting with the community, which is very much in line with how Mayor-elect de Blasio has talked about this community policing, where if people are on the ground and they know the neighborhood and they know the neighbors, that will in itself improve the relationship between the NYPD and communities.
Now, before we take some of the calls from people who are not incoming elected officials, I just want to play this clip that kind of sets up the calls from Mayor-elect de Blasio speaking over the weekend to a Reverend Al Sharpton National Action Network audience in Harlem. Remember, Sharpton backed de Blasio in the Democratic primary, not Bill Thompson, as he had also been considering. De Blasio told the group he will need their activism in the coming term as he tries to be aggressively progressive.
There is a powerful impulse in people to not just look at the problem, but then get ready for the solution and get ready to be part of the solution. That is the view I bring, the ethos I bring to this, the belief that the people of this city are ready for change and are ready to be part of making the change.
I think what's so interesting when you listen to de Blasio speak now is we are shifting, you know, out of the campaign mode, but into almost like a new campaign mode, which is reminding the people who supported him and who elected him that he cannot do this alone, that if he's going to, you know, get this aggressive, progressive agenda through Albany and through the city council, that he's going to need the support of all of these people who went to the, you know, to the ballot box and voted for him. And, you know, basically what he went on to say to that audience is, you know, when I go to Albany to, you know, push for raising taxes on the wealthiest New Yorkers to pay for universal pre-K and after school programs, I can't go there alone. You need to be there with me. And I will come back and say to you, you need to be there with me. And so I think it's sort of setting up the city and the public to recognize that he's expecting their engagement to support his agenda.
And that would be different from the previous administration, by the way, right? It was Bloomberg through the force of his managerial abilities who felt that he could get things through Albany, which he sometimes did, sometimes didn't, or through whatever. It does look like de Blasio, true to his roots as a community organizer, is going to be a very different mayor in that respect, at least the way he's starting out.
Right. He wants community engagement. He wants to be on the ground and have consensus building from the street level up, which is very different than what Bloomberg has done. Bloomberg has said leaders get out in front of a crowd and sort of dictate where to go from there. But what I think is interesting about de Blasio's comments about engagement is that it's a different emphasis than what you heard during the campaign or even just a few days ago when reporters said, what's your plan B if this doesn't work? And he's always said it's going to work
for pre-K,
for getting state legislators in an election year to pass a tax hike and get approval from Andrew Cuomo, who is running for re-election in 2014, which, if the opportunity arises, could be a stepping stone to 2016 in the White House. And he's always said, you don't negotiate against yourself. Plan A is going to work. This is going to happen. And now when he's talking more directly to voters, he's saying, I need your help. It almost sounds as if it's a tacit acknowledgement that the task he had put forward and said he can accomplish is going to be a little bit harder than he's acknowledged.
I think what was also interesting, and if you listen to the whole speech, the way Reverend Al Sharpton introduced him, he talked about the fact that, you know, Mayor-elect de Blasio was not a savior. He was just a mayor. And when you listen to other surrogates and supporters of the incoming de Blasio administration, they talk about how there will be naysayers. And they sort of are, I feel like, priming the pump for some of the pushback that they're anticipating that they'll get when they try to move this agenda forward. And they're framing for their supporters that they need to stick with it, you know, push beyond the naysayers.
But I wonder if he was also trying to diminish expectations a little bit, because there was this Obama as savior thing that, you know, that Republicans were pushing to mock Obama because of the way people reacted to him during the first campaign.
He's the one.
Exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. But it also set expectations so high that when Obama ran into real politics in Washington, people started getting disappointed in him after they'd supported him.
Well, that was exactly how Sharpton introduced de Blasio. He said, we saw this with Obama. Now, to compare de Blasio and Obama, I mean, you could have a field day trying to do that one. But to set him up as someone who is coming in with high hopes from progressives, because we all rallied around him with such, you know, in such numbers, and Sharpton was saying, that's what we saw with Obama. And then he said, and then you all stayed home. And that's where it fell short. Now, if you believe that, fine. Now, is the answer to have more people go up to Albany and rally and protest? Well, we saw this with a number of other issues, and it's unclear sometimes how effective yelling and screaming in Albany can be.
Let's see what people would put on some of their aggressive progressive stickers if they actually went down to the transition tent at Duarte Square in Lower Manhattan. Lumiere in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lumiere. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I love your show.
Thank you.
I get so much information from you. I have to say he has to be aggressively progressive, and I reiterate that this is not going to happen unless the people rally up. And maybe we need to find new forms how to rally up behind him, because what we have now is a whole city of agencies that are not working. I would like him to put a moratorium on the housing court at 111 Center Street on all holdover cases, because it's completely a kangaroo court. I would like him to go in and investigate all the protective services that have been allowed to be bought out under Bloomberg's, giving carte blanche to all the developers. There's a lot here that's going on that the public is unaware of, because a lot of people are suffering that are trying to survive. I personally am fighting them just as a single 66-year-old woman. And I'm going to tell you now, I'm going to start the revolution in this city.
All right. Lumiere, starting the revolution with Bill de Blasio. Revolution from the top. And, of course, she means that in a political sense.
The revolution will be aired on the radio, I guess.
I guess. So it will be tweeted, that's for sure. Alan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan. What's on your sticker?
Saving enough money from externality taxes and savings on material waste and energy use in the city that both the public and the private sector will have enough additional cash left over that they can be revenue streams for the kind of liberal agenda on education and housing and social services that de Blasio wants to have. Instead of just asking for more of the kinds of taxes we've had before, we can rely more on tapping externality taxes and reducing general revenue taxes.
Can you think the city could do that, or does the nation have to do that, like packaging taxes and stuff?
Packaging taxes can happen at the local, state, or national level. We can do that and be an example for the nation.
All right. Thank you very much. Carlina in Red Hook, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carlina. What would be on your sticker?
Hi. Good morning. Love your show. Definitely the waterfront. I head the nonprofit Portside, New York. And so it's all about the waterfront. And I would say open up the waterfront for boats. It's been opened up for pedestrians. And to get to that, you need better pier design and management and less paper chase. So it's been a bit of a waterfront where money talks, and particularly historic and cultural vessels, but boats of every type are really having a hard time in New York City.
Does that include for you, by the way, more water taxis as a means of transportation, let's say from Queens and Brooklyn to Manhattan and back?
Well, certainly. I mean, at Portside, we advocate for waterborne transportation. And I would say, yes, more ferry service. There's been great progress, but there could be more routes to here. But also, honestly, routes that don't only go to Manhattan. It's so Manhattan-centric. I mean, to be able to move east through a ferry, started to do that up and down the shore. But I would often like to get to Staten Island. There used to be ferries Brooklyn to Staten Island, even directly to New Jersey. So I think ultimately that's a network that all roads don't go to Manhattan. Mm-hmm.
Carlina, thank you very much. Abdul in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Abdul. What would be on your sticker at the transition tent?
Yes, he should appoint. First, he should investigate all the past atrocities against Muslims in the city, surveillance of our mosque and implanting provocateurs inside our mosque. And he should appoint 25% of New York City's population is Muslim and scheduled to grow to, I believe, it would be 40% in 20 years. So he should allow more permits for mosques. And then he should restart the Wall Street movement, 99%. And this time it should be labeled as Destroy Wall Street, because Wall Street only feeds the Upper East Side, just 1% or 2% of the population of the city. Nobody else. The rest are just janitors and bookkeepers.
Abdul, thank you very much. Okay. I don't think he's going to go for Destroy Wall Street.
That may be the position that makes him look like a moderate, is to oppose the Destroy Wall Street movement.
Go ahead.
I think it is interesting that the, talking transitions tent is located on this piece of property where folks who were from the Occupy Wall Street movement tried to gather about a year ago. And also, when I was there, it was interesting to talk to people who were very much from that movement. It is similar to what they were doing in Zuccotti Park, getting together, having conversations, parsing issues, except this time they have a really nice tent and chairs and heat and refreshments.
And he wants Wall Street companies to stay in New York,
right,
to keep providing jobs in New York, to keep paying a lot of taxes in New York. And, you know, that must be one of the internal conversations, is how much can we critique that industry and its downsides and tax the people who seem to be making windfalls while other people are janitors, et cetera, in greater numbers. We see the story today about the median household income in New York going down. And the and at the same time, not have them move more office jobs to Charlotte or Westchester or wherever they can move them. So we are almost out of time. I just want to throw a national angle on this as a transition to our next guest, Molly Ball from The Atlantic. One thing I've noticed is that national politics watchers, Sunday morning talk show pundits, and people like that are beginning to include de Blasio's election in their analysis of the country more. And I think at first it was, oh, the People's Republic of New York City, that's a separate trend from the nation as a whole. But now it's more like Democrats around America want their politicians to be really liberal with this ongoing mild economic depression that we're in, as Paul Krugman refers to it today. And so there's increasing buzz about Elizabeth Warren challenging Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination, that Noam Schieber piece in the New Republic that's getting passed around a lot and was talked about a lot on TV yesterday. The Times did an article on New York's liberal Working Families Party developing more national influence. And people are realizing, oh, de Blasio's election may be about more than New York being New York. Maybe it's about 2013 Democrats being 2013 Democrats in a time of chronically stagnating wages and record stock prices. So maybe it actually connects to something. Any comment about my rant there?
One of the panels I listened to yesterday was Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation.
Down in the transition tent.
Down in that transition tent. And
it wasn't a David Gregory panel on Meet the Press.
It could have been. I mean, she, as you know, she is the editor-in-chief of The Nation, which was, you know, obviously it's a progressive left-leaning publication. They endorsed Bill de Blasio, you know, as he was on his surge, but early in the primary race. And, you know, she has made an outspoken case for the rise of progressive politics across the country. And what was interesting about the conversation was, to your point, she pointed to places around the country where progressives, even she mentioned that in Seattle, Washington, a socialist candidate had been elected to the city council there, and really said that, you know, Mark pointed to it as a change in the conversation and sort of how we think about policy in this country. And, you know, as a backlash to the rise of, you know, corporate gifts and, you know, that Occupy Wall Street mentality sort of taking root in actual politics.
Right. So the idea that Democrats really like people who are progressive, it has like sort of been around for a while. And there's a few anomalies in this New York City race that helped de Blasio sort of rise on that. But he campaigned on the idea of that New York suffers from an income inequality. And he campaigned on it. He highlighted it every time the campaign tweeted it. It got retweeted a lot. They drove that message. Now comes the question of how much can a mayor change that? Now that you've campaigned on identifying the problem, 4 years from now, what is the yardstick by which you will be measured in terms of fixing it? Is it literally reducing it? Or, as some people have said, it is reducing the pain of that. Hmm. Do you invest in schools and public libraries and transportation to help someone who makes $30,000 a year get along further with their dollar? Or do you literally have to shrink that gap between the haves and have-nots?
And by the way, I refer you all to our website if you're interested, where the WNYC Data Guru Department has this great map about the median income report that just came out. The city's median income has dropped from $54,000 to less than $51,000 in the last few years. And you can go neighborhood by neighborhood on the map and see some surprises. You'd see the Upper West Side and Upper East Side median incomes have dropped, while Brooklyn Heights, Fort Greene, Bedford Stuyvesant, and Central Harlem have all gone up. Probably more a function of who's moving where than anything else. But still, the median income as a whole has dropped in New York City noticeably over the last few years. So you can go check that out neighborhood by neighborhood at wnyc.org. And we thank WNYC political reporter Bridget Bergen, Capital New York political reporter, Ozzie Pabra at Ozzie. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And we will get the national view on that same question about de Blasio and then talk about what's going on in Washington with Molly Ball, national politics correspondent for The Atlantic. Coming up next, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.